This podcast is produced by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, President. KPP Financial. Independent thinking, shared success. And now today's podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our Monday, November 20th edition of Invest Talk. And as always, we are here to help you become an above average investor. And this is always a two-way conversation, and it's always about your money. And as always, your questions are welcome. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but you can catch us live 4 to 5 Pacific time each and every weekday. So you can get a live call then or leave a message after hours on 888-99-CHART and we'll answer your question in an upcoming show. Now we'll get to that in a moment. Now the question is, where do you stand on balance sheets? Do you use them in your research? They can be kind of scary with the terms like deferred tax assets and accumulated other comprehensive income. They can be a daunting task to go over. I mean, in good times, investors tend to largely ignore weak balance sheets because money is usually flowing. Liquidity is usually high, right? And most businesses can borrow freely. So a balance sheet strength or weakness doesn't matter too much because, well, maybe if the balance sheet's weak and they need to pay a little extra to borrow, the bottom line is they can still borrow. However, in tough times, weak balance sheets can drive companies into making poor long-term business decisions, or many times they can drive them out of business when liquidity dries up and suddenly the lenders are a little bit more focused on strength of balance sheets and less likely to risk it on marginal credits. So what do you look for in a balance sheet? For one thing, to what degree is a business cyclical? Now that's separate from the balance sheet, but that's something you have to take into context when you're studying it. Each of the 11 major industries in the market today have various levels of sensitivity to the economic cycle. And each of them have their own secular, not cyclical, but secular trends long term. Right, one example right now would be retail and the secular trend of online retail. That's certainly a headwind to brick and mortar retail. That doesn't mean that every brick and mortar store is bad or is not a good investment. It's just a headwind. And there's ways that you can overcome that by good leadership, good brand, etc. And that's just one small example of secular, and cyclical is always the economic cycle. So sectors like commodities, retail, finance, right, banks, they tend to be very cyclical. While utility companies, maybe consumer staple companies, tend to hold up fairly well during tough economic times. So non-cyclical companies can handle a weaker balance sheet over the long term as opposed to cyclical companies. You just have to go back to the last recession. What type of companies went out of business? Banks, car companies, commodity companies. These tend to move up and down dramatically with the economic cycle. Then you have to look at liquidity, current assets over current liabilities, meaning how much money are they holding or assets are they holding that they can get their hands on and liquidate quickly to pay off any current liabilities that are really close to having to be paid. And in current is less than a year. It's a current asset or current liability. So this is known as the liquidity ratio, which basically tells you, can they pay their bills in the near term? Then there's debt-to-equity ratio, which is the leverage the company has, how much debt it has compared to the equity on its balance sheet. And there's no hard and fast rule that one is terrible and, you know, anything above three is really, really bad? It depends on the industry. So looking back at previous trends, looking at competitors, what happened? Where was it the last recession? What was their balance sheet leverage then? Could they handle it? Is it higher? Is it lower? How has their business changed since then? So these are all very, very important figures. And debt to equity ratio, the higher the number, the weaker the company balance sheet has become. So the bottom line, don't be afraid of the balance sheet. Study up on them a little. And it's very important, especially when you're looking at companies that have a decent amount of debt on their balance sheet, especially compared to the market cap of the stock. Think of GE currently. It's one example. They have a lot of debt. Do they have too much? We'll see. Now, time to go to our 24-hour listener line and check for questions. And here's one that came in before today's Invest Talk.
Hi, this is Lynn calling from Wisconsin. I have a really basic question that I actually never even thought about. Why, I don't know. But here's the question. When a bunch of people go in and buy stocks of a company, where does that money go? And is it sent to the company? And then what happens when people sell their stock? Is that money required to be paid out? So maybe a dumb question, but really curious. Thanks for your help and enjoy your show.
Great question. It's a question I think a lot of beginners probably have. Where do cash flows, how do cash flows work within the market? Well, simply when you're buying a stock that's already been issued, right, it's out there trading in the marketplace, you're just passing money between the seller and the buyer, right? The buyer is giving the seller an X amount per share, multiply that times the number of shares, minus any commissions from the broker, and that's what money is transferred, okay? The company doesn't have much to do with it. Because when they get money is during the IPO, the initial public offering. So what they do is they go out in the marketplace. They're not public, but they want to go public, and they go to an investment bank, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, something like that. And the investment bank's job is to go out there and sell it to usually institutions. That's the easiest way that they sell the IPO. They go on a roadshow a lot of times, which simply means that they're going out there and pitching the merits of the investment in this company and why it's worth X valuation. And it's the investment bank's job to get the company as high as price as it can for its company from a market cap perspective, market valuation perspective. And that is when the company gets cash. Right. Usually it is existing shareholders, or it's always going to be existing shareholders that are selling part of the business to the public. It's usually not 100% of the business, usually some percentage, usually owned by executives, maybe VC firms, angel investors, companies or investors that seeded the investment to start off. Right. Who put up the money to start the business? And those are the ones that are usually cashing out millions and millions of dollars. Now, some of that is going into the coffers of the business as well for capital that they need to fund the business, right? Think of Tesla right now. Tesla, they're issuing more and more stock. And this happens not just the first time, but companies can issue more stock throughout time. And the board will approve it. They'll do the same thing, but instead of initial shareholders selling it, it's usually just them creating shares. Tesla's a good example, and throwing it out in their into the market, and the company replenishes its coffers and uses it for business purposes. And in Tesla's case, they're going to use it to try to build more factories, build more cars, do all the things that they're going to try to do. Obviously, they're burning hundreds of millions of dollars a month. But, and they need that money, right? And some companies do the opposite. They might go out and buy shares back in the open market using money that they've made through the business or borrowed from the bond market. So I hope that clarifies. I know that I kind of went a little deeper than you may have liked, but I try to give you a full perspective of where those funds go, where they flow to. And it just depends on a particular situation. But great question. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein on this Thanksgiving week. Stocks traditionally do well during Thanksgiving, with the S&P 500 up 75% of the time for an average gain of 0.6% since 1945. Now, this Thanksgiving week, traders are watching Fed Chair Yellen on Tuesday, tax reform, and a few economic releases as well, such as durable goods, existing home sales, in the holiday shortened week. Glad you're with us today. Please join in now on the phone at 888-99-CHART. Now, let's look at our list of topics today. First is when gold is not as good as gold. We're going to talk about ways that you could invest in gold, ways that you could potentially get duped in that marketplace as well. You know, it's not foolproof, just like any investment, and it probably should be part of everyone's portfolio to a degree. It's just a matter of how much, and we're going to talk about ways that you can get exposure there in the right ways. Now, we also have other talking points as well. One is, what are some signs that you're on track for retirement? Some signs that you are on track for retirement. Also, science shows this is how you can make better investment decisions. We've been studying the brain for decades now with imaging technology, and they've uncovered a few characteristics of the brain that lend some insight into how you can build the skills to make better decisions. And it's not that much different than playing a sport or any other high-pressure situation. And then lastly, the yield curve. It's flattening. What does that mean? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Does it not mean as much because of how low rates are? So we're going to talk about that. But ultimately, it's up to you. We want to know what's on your mind this hour. 888-99-CHART is how to reach me right now. We have about 35 minutes left, 38 minutes left in the show. So the sooner you call in, the sooner we can answer your questions and have time to do it. Now let's take a look at the market today. We had the Dow up 72, S&P up 3, NASDAQ up 7. Really a modest update in the markets. Not a whole lot of economic news on this front. What was interesting was value stocks actually did a little bit better. The FANG stocks, the tech stocks were a little weak. Commodities were a little weak. And that was really the long and short of it today. You have Yellen talking tomorrow. We're still, you know, the tax plan, although it passed the House, one of the two, Senate, House, can't remember off the top of my head, but they still haven't passed in the other. And it's certainly going to be changed to some degree, and it's going to be infighting. So the market's still ready and waiting for any news on that front to see if it actually finally fully gets passed. So this is Invest Talk. I want to hear from you. I'm Justin Klein. I welcome your money questions, and we can talk live right now, 4 to 5 Pacific time. Whatever's on your mind, whatever money questions that you might have, maybe it's about Bitcoin. Maybe it's about Tesla. Maybe it's about the bond market. Maybe it's about annuities. Maybe it's about knowing how much you need to retire. Maybe it's about retail stocks, dividend stocks, options, whatever it is. You can use that same number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Once again, it's 888-99-CHART. Let's go to Art in Menlo Park. How you doing, Art?
Good, Justin. How are you today?
Doing great. What can I do for you?
I just wanted to get some information. I'm actually trying to get some do a little research on this company called Elekta. And it's got two symbols.
Okay.
Seems like they're the same company, EKTAY and also EKTAK. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that they're both very lightly traded, and like I say, I think it's a company, but is there a reason
why it's not trading that much? I can't hear you, Art. Well, you're looking at Elekta, and you're right, it is lightly traded. And the reason is because it's on the pink sheets. The average volume is about 13,000 shares a day. Now, today it did trade 215,000 shares, but it's not listed on a major exchange. And that's why you're not getting much information on it. Why it is, I'm not sure. It looks like a foreign company. Is that true, Art?
Yes. I think it's out of Switzerland or something.
Okay. Yeah, Switzerland sounds correct. So it's not listed on our major exchanges. That means there's not a lot of regulation around accounting, etc. But I do have some. But it's not a small company. It's a $3.3 billion market cap, modest amount of debt. It's trading at about 23 times enterprise value to EBITDA, which is not exactly cheap. You know, I like to see that roughly about half of that number. So that worries me a little bit. It's not super cheap. Do you know anything about their products? From what I understand, they're in the healthcare field, right? They develop, manufacture, and distribute treatment planning systems for hospitals globally. So it's a software provider for neurosurgery, radiotherapy, stereotactic radiosurgery, and brachytherapy. So they're pretty decent sized company. Let me look at their cash flows. They look like they do a good business. Where did you find this? Usually people aren't coming to us with pink sheet companies.
Well, actually, somebody was telling me about this company, so I wanted to do a little research on it. But I think what they do is they try to implement MRIs with specifically targeting certain areas of wherever your tumor is.
So their revenue is about flat, but their profits and their cash flow is actually going up. It's over double since 2014 so it's doing very well from a profitability standpoint. Revenues are just okay growth wise, but it's certainly profitable. Let me look at its EBITDA. It pays about a 1% dividend, 1.5% forward yield, and it looks like it can pay that just fine. You're certainly going to get some foreign currency fluctuations because of it being domiciled elsewhere. Actually, it looks like their EBITDA has been falling, but it's starting to rise again. So, you know, to me, it's not expensive. It's not cheap either, and the profitability is starting to go up. So it's very high risk because it's a pink sheet, and I just don't really like the valuation at this point. It's still not cheap enough for me to really dive into it. Let me look at the technicals real quick, make sure the chart is at least trending in the right direction. It's trying to load for me. No, it's below its moving averages. I don't like it. It's not trading enough. It's not safe enough. But thanks for the call, Art. Let's go to Sam in Hayward. How you doing, Sam?
Oh, fine, Justin. Thank you very much. Justin, real quick, on Dycom, it's symbol DY. I got in about 89, so I'm just wondering, it seems to have taken a jump today. Is it time to get out? I don't know.
So you bought it, and you were down or what?
Yeah, I bought it when it was about $89.
Okay, so you were down a little bit, went down to the high 70s, and now it's rallied all close to $100 a share. So you're wondering, take your 10% and get out is your question.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
Well, let's look at what they do first. Dycom Industries provides specialty contracting services in the United States and Canada, and it's mainly focused on the telecom industry. But it does do, it helps with the cell towers, I would imagine, and building infrastructure for the telecom industry. Their profitability doesn't look like it's changed much. Over the last year or so, but their revenues are certainly going up. But the free cash flow and operating cash flow remains fairly static from 2016. Their return on equity is very high, mid-20s. Return on invested capital, 11-12% or so, which is decent. You know, it's from a valuation standpoint, it's certainly not extremely cheap, I'll tell you that much. And let me look at its debt levels. It's trying to load for me. You have a decent amount of debt, that worries me. It's really just consolidating long term. I don't hate it. I actually would keep it. I know it's you got to make sure you understand the risk here, because it's certainly going to fluctuate. But I actually think it looks pretty good. Revenues and earnings are rising, and it's not a terrible valuation. So I'd hold it.
Our podcast continues next. One of the main lessons for investors in 2008, stop trying to time the market. How many people got out and then stayed out, waiting for that correction that never came? Steve and the staff at KPP Financial employ the latest investing technology, guided by years of experience in finding opportunities and moderating risk for their clients, investing right along with their clients. KPP didn't get out of the market in 2008. They were defensive, but they stayed with the market. Long term, that's the safest place to be. That's the main lesson. If you'd like help with the ins and outs of today's market, look at the series of investment programs for all life situations from KPP Financial. Just click on the Investments tab on investtalk.com. Now let's get back to our podcast. This is Invest Talk, 1 hour of financial news and perspective, where you can talk directly with a registered investment advisor. Bring your questions right now. Our direct line is 888-99-CHART.
Good as gold. Not always true for investments in the gold industry, and gold investments tend to fluctuate more than the stock market. They're a little more volatile than the overall market, but that goes with commodities in general, right? Because you have the fluctuation of speculators and supply and demand within the industry, as well as the movement in currencies, which certainly will affect gold investments, as well as inflation expectations. So gold in many times moves in reverse of what stocks and bonds are doing, or just maybe uncorrelated is a good way to describe it. Now, if you do decide that gold investments sound like something that is needed within your portfolio based on your based on diversification, your goals, and risk tolerance as well, then there's various ways that you can get exposure to gold. First is mutual funds, and some mutual funds track the individual price of gold. Others track gold miners or precious metal miners. So understanding the fees involved with that, and the making sure that whoever's managing it knows what they're doing. That's certainly number one when it comes to any mutual fund, and that kind of applies to ETFs as well. There can be hidden costs that dilute the amount of money you have, or the amount of gold, sorry, you have, and I believe gold is money to a degree. And you also be aware that ETFs may be subject to higher rates of taxation. So you got to read the prospectus and consult with a tax attorney if you are getting exposure to individual gold. If you're exposed to the miners, it's just like owning in any stock, right? Just any commodity company. But when it comes to gold holdings, there can be different tax ramifications there. Now, going to stock in mining companies, you can invest them directly into a mining company. And certainly that's going to be tied to the price of gold, right? When the price of gold rises, so will the price of mining stocks in general, and vice versa. And also know that they tend to be more volatile. They're actually about 3 times more volatile than the price of gold. So understand that. And that can be a good thing when gold prices are going up, and it can be a rough thing when it's not. Then you can also buy physical gold. Certainly, this is probably the safest way to own gold. But you can also get duped, right, by buying maybe fake gold. We're dealing with the wrong dealers. So you got to do your own due diligence to ensure that you don't get ripped off. You can buy gold coins, which is kind of like buying physical gold, but there's also that added layer of quality and current demand for those particular gold coins, market sentiment, economic factors as well. So understand these variables, and you can successfully add gold to your portfolio. Let's go to John in San Jose. How you doing, John?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing great. What can I do for you?
Yeah, enjoy your show. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about preferred stocks ETF. The symbol is PFF, that is Peter Frank Frank. What did you see, what do you think about or feel about getting into this for years, even in a rising interest rate environment?
So you're looking at the preferred share ETF. It's the iShares U.S. Preferred Stock ETF. One of the most popular preferred, if not the most popular preferred shared ETF out there. And it does yield about 5.75%. So I'm sure you're really after that yield, right?
Yes, you got it.
Okay. And are you, and you're worried about maybe interest rate risk in this environment?
Interest rate as well as credit risk. I mean, if I look at the chart for the last few years, this stock or this ETF has been stable around 38, 39, or maybe 37 and 39. But so I was wondering if there is, typically in a rising rate environment, this should go down, right? Is that already factored in?
Yes.
In other words, if I get into it now for yield, what is the capital risk now going forward?
Well, there's two risks when it comes to preferred shares. One is that interest rate risk that you're talking about, and preferred shares have a very high sensitivity to interest rates. One is the fact that they tend to pay less in yield than your typical stock, and or high yield investment. And two is there's really not a lot of the maturity date is usually a long time. Meaning it goes out for extended period, 20, 30 years a lot of times. It depends on the holdings and when those preferred shares expire. Some of them never expire, right? It's just a perpetual preferred. And so there's that risk. And then there's the economic risk. Remember, preferred shares are much lower on the capital structure than bonds, which are first in line, and stocks are behind the preferred shareholders. So during bad economic times, right, in 2008, this went from about $45 a share all the way down to 19. So you lost over 50% of the value of the fund during that time because of defaults, and usually preferred shares are issued a lot of times on banks. Right, for the top holdings for this fund are Wells Fargo, HSBC, Allergan, which is not a bank, but you have Barclays, which is a bank, and then GMAC, which is kind of like a bank. So four of the five top holdings are banks who are very economically sensitive, and you know, will the next recession cause banking problems? It's hard to know, but understand that those are the two main risks. It's both cyclically and defaults on those particular companies potentially, and then the interest rate risk as well.
Right. But the interest rate is kind of known now, right, that it's going to be on an upward path. So is that, do you think that is already factored in the stock price, or when the interest rates actually rise, then the stock price would go down?
No, I would say the interest rate movement is kind of, it's tied to the interest rate movement. So it's not priced in. Whatever's priced in for what the market expects going forward is already priced into the bond market, which thus is priced into the preferred share market. So I would say no, it's not priced in at this point. So if interest rates do rise substantially, then certainly you're going to get hit with some interest rate risk here as well. How much, you know, how much those that moves is hard to know. But certainly the preferred shares are certainly a higher risk area of the income market. I would say even higher than the junk bond market to a degree.
Oh, really?
They're similar in a lot of ways. Yeah, they're similar in a lot of ways, but they're not exactly the same type of risk, but they are similar to a degree.
Oh, good. Thanks for the perspective. I appreciate it.
No problem, John. Thanks for calling. Now, it may be hard to believe, but the average 401k investor misses out on over $5,000 per year in investment gains. Why? Well, poor timing and subpar investment choices. This is what the studies show us. And that's why we have Active 401k. That's why we launched the program for our listeners and our clients, because it's very difficult to allocate a 401k account. It's really up to you and you alone. You got to make the changes. Now, if you have a 401k account, this is a program that you should know about. And to learn more about it, just go to investtalk.com, click on the Investments tab.
How much time should I have to spend to properly manage my retirement portfolio? Do I need a living trust? How much life insurance should I have? Should beginners start out with individual stocks? How much of my portfolio should be in dividend-paying stocks? All important questions. If you're looking for answers, you're welcome to ask the financial questions important to you. Call 888-99-CHART.
Let's talk a little bit about some ways to know that you're on track for retirement. Now, 66% of Americans have less than $50,000 in savings. Two-thirds. It's pretty wild, especially considering 50 grand is not a lot of money to retire on. And even if you include Social Security, you're going to need some sort of supplemental income on top of that. Now, the first step is to understand that you picked the right retirement date. And this has a major impact on your finances in retirement for many reasons. One, when you start when you retire, you stop saving and you start spending all of that savings money, most likely, unless you are just living off of Social Security and your pension. So you got to make sure that you have your savings accounts to the point that will last you the rest of your life comfortably. Second, your age will determine your payout for Social Security. The longer you wait up until 70, the bigger your payout will be on a monthly basis. So you should always try to wait until your full retirement age, 67, 68, depending on your age. Today or when what year you're born, that changes. And these payouts will make it easier to save enough for retirement, because as long as those payouts are bigger, that means less income you're going to need to produce from your savings. And number three is, if you're fortunate to have a pension, the longer you're working for that employer and the less number of years that they're having to pay you out, the more money you're going to get from your pension. So picking the right retirement age and date is very, very important. Then next, you need to calculate your income needs. And the way you figure this out is you look at how much income you'll need over Social Security benefits as well as pension benefits, you know, any income that you're going to get in retirement. So are you going to need an extra $1,000 a month, $5,000 a month? And that calculation will be extremely important to know how much money you're going to need in retirement to retire. And then you also need to understand your risk tolerance. What type of investments are you comfortable with? in retirement? Are you conservative? Are you moderate? Maybe you're an aggressive investor. Probably shouldn't be in retirement, but at least be moderate, conservative. That's part of that strategy. Now, lastly, you have to constantly save enough to hit your goals. So you need to know, once you know how much you're going to need, you got to figure out, okay, how much do I need to save a month? Based on not only how much I have today, but what type of investments am I making? What type of return should I expect from those investments? All those can be a significant factor. And then, are you managing your retirement savings wisely? What you do with all of that money you've been saving will make or break your retirement plans. You know, that's why we have the active 401k, because we know people need help managing their 401k. That's why we manage IRAs for clients. So allocating that money between stocks and bonds and other assets, real estate, to maximize your returns while also minimizing the risk that you have to that money, right? Because if you lose half of your current nest egg, suddenly that saving schedule and that investment schedule looks a lot different. Now let's get back to our 24-hour listener line and pick up another question at 888-99-CHART.
This is a question for InvestTalk from Jay in Chicago. I wanted to find out if you have any recommendations for HSA providers with good investment options. I'm unable to find any companies that offer cheap investment options for the HSA, which I intend to use mainly as a retirement savings vehicle. Thank you, and I'll listen off the line.
From my understanding is that HSAs are usually offered through your employer, so you probably don't have control over that. I could be wrong. I've never heard anyone opening their own HSA account. Never heard that. So I can't give you any recommendations of who you should go through, because it's always been through the employer, and the employer retirement plan or employer benefit plan, and you know that varies widely depending on size of the company and what they want to offer, etc. So I've never heard you be able to open one on your own, but I could be wrong. Now you're listening to InvestTalk. I'm Justin Klein. The hour is going by fast, and we have just a few moments remaining in the hour. You can reach me now with your questions at 888-99-CHART. Let's go to BJ in San Ramon. How you doing, BJ? BJ, you there? Hello, hello.
I hope you did not get disconnected.
I'm not hearing BJ. Let's go to Gene in North Carolina. How you doing, Gene?
Hey, Justin. Thanks for taking my call. You were just talking about HSAs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have an individual HSA for the last 10 years. They are...
Oh, really?
You
okay.
You can get them through your employer, but you also can buy them as an individual if you have an individual health, insurance, health insurance policy, just like you buy an IRA.
Gotcha.
So you
have to purchase your health insurance policy yourself?
For mine, it's an individual health insurance policy, right? And the HSA is independent of that. You buy it the same way you set up an IRA, for example, with a brokerage account, mm-hmm. or a mutual, yep. fund or a bank.
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with that. You're limited on the fund choices, or is it like an IRA you can invest in any stock or anything like that?
Well, it depends on your who you get it from. When it started about, mm-hmm. When I had started about 10 years ago, the only people really who offered it for individual HSAs were banks, and they really charged you a lot by monthly fees, and you really didn't get anywhere. There are individual mutual fund companies that allow you to set up an HSA with them the same way you would set up an IRA with them. The big brokerage accounts like Fidelity, Vanguard, and so forth, they don't allow individual HSAs, but they do have some HSAs that you can get for if through your employer. There are also some third-party companies that allow you to invest in Vanguard funds through them, but they're third-party and they charge you a small percentage.
Interesting.
So you really
have
to look around. It's a little bit.
I'm definitely going to call TD. Yeah, I'm going to call TD Ameritrade tomorrow and look into this because that's who we use for our clients, for our brokers, as our broker. So great information. Thank you for calling because I've never really dealt with them, never really looked into them too much. I knew that they were limited and they're not the easiest thing to work
they're
with.
They're not mainstream.
But I always thought they were. Yeah, they're not mainstream. But, you know, as people are trying to find ways to save more and more in their retirement accounts, might not be a bad way to go. So I'm definitely going to look into it. And, Gene, thanks for calling and give us an update.
Thank you.
No problem. Let's go to Robbie in Santa Clara. How you doing, Robbie?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm doing good. So I have a 401k facility. Is there any way to buy a gold electronically rather than buying ETFs or funds?
So you want to buy gold electronically?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Who's going to hold the gold?
Myself.
Okay, so you want to hold the gold, but you want to hold that within your 401k?
Correct.
Well, it's not really possible because whoever's custodying your 401k is holding the assets. Can't hold that separately outside of your 401k. Now, there are ETFs and funds that actually hold the physical gold. Like if you're buying GLD, that is kind of paper assets, holding the paper version of gold. Right, they're holding contracts to own gold. Now there are funds. CEF is one off the top of my head. CEF, I think it holds the physical gold in Canada, but the carrying costs on that are certainly higher than GLD. So that's one way you can do it. But you can't physically take control of that. Whoever's holding your 401k needs to do that.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Robbie. Now time to wrap it up. Looking at Steve's portfolio checkup calendar, he'll be in San Jose for his individual retirement reviews on December 6th. To reserve your hour with him before his day is filled up, just go to investtalk.com and click on the Invest Talk tab. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein, Chief Executive Officer of KP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm. And Steve and I thank you for being with us. On behalf of the whole KP family, we wish you a happy Thanksgiving. Let's meet again here tomorrow for InvestTalk.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.